Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Tom Baker,
and I'm the Sixth Doctor in Doctor Who,
and I'm talking to you for TMVCafe.com.
Going into time. And of course, I'm joined with our one-eyed coffee-drinking Pam.
Hello.
And then we have, of course, as you heard, Miss Stephanie.
Hi.
And we'll give you more details on her. But there's another person in the panel here also. We have to have, because where we're going to need two different sides of the coin here. So everyone knows the snarkiest skeptic out there. I mean, I've heard rumors even from the Werepig himself that this guy has debunked his own existence. So, yeah. But without further ado, here we also have Mr. Allen with us tonight.
Yes, I had to reappear in a poof of illogic.
Yes. And what a show! Last minute pulled together, but amazing panel to do it, right?
All right, I'm curious about A. I see a floating cat.
Yeah, that's what all right, he does.
On one picture, there's a cat imitating John Lennon.
Right.
And another picture is a wolf that allegedly only has one eye. I got to hear that story. Okay. And then there's, you know, somebody being beamed up into the bottom of a cat.
Yeah, let's just hope that's
just
being beamed up.
That just can't be good.
I just really hope that's being beamed up, not, yeah.
You
well,
will.
You know, the other option is, let's put it this way, I agree with that commercial. If you're a cat, you ignore people. It's what you do.
Exactly.
Oh, this is going to be an interesting show because I'm already wiping the tears off my cheeks.
We have yet begun to snark.
Right?
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. Well, okay. There was this interesting topic that was kind of mentioned in the show before about some people that have said they've got video and there's, some kind of photographic evidence as well of individuals who have, in a sense, time traveled. And
yeah, I'm familiar.
Okay, see, now, Alan...
Photoshop.
Thank you. Alan was, like, right on the money with me right there. Just I laughed. But then again, I have to go back because there is a science side that says they are attempting to make something like this happen. I don't know where they stand with it. But then there is, of course, a lot of us know the skeptical side of it because we're like, no, it's just not going to happen. So... we have the science side, which is Miss Stephanie, who is a NASA rocket scientist and international woman of mystery. I have to throw that in there. And then, of course,
Interstellar.
There you go. And then we have, of course, Alan, who has been great at coming in and helping debunk a lot of stuff over the years. So, there, you know, you have to. It's a skeptic versus believer show. So we want the science side in there, and we have to have the skeptic side in there, and then we have to have the dog side in there.
Right. Sorry, they're my alarm clock for the show.
Man, I'm already biting my tongue. It's just been one of those weeks. What can we say? You know? You know, Stephanie, I have to look at you and go, all right, in your science community, can you talk to your brethren through whatever psychic communications you have? And when they say things like, we're going to wake up a 30,000-year-old giant virus found under the Siberian ice, at some point does the, is this a good idea, ever asked?
Well, it depends which group you're talking to, frankly. I'm perfectly serious about that. There are some that would say, my gosh, what the bleep do you think you're doing? And there are others who would say, science! So,
yes. And, you know, and we're talking about time travel.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know this virus wasn't cranky when it went to bed?
Yeah.
Because it's going to wake up. It's been lying at the bottom of a frozen pond for 30,000 years.
Okay.
It doesn't know that mastodons are not available for lunch.
No, but see,
well, it's worse than that. If it's something that we haven't seen in 30,000 years, that means we have no resistance to it.
Yeah, but I want to know, how does someone determine the time of it? First of all, it's been there for so long, and I know whoever's discovered it is not old enough to say, oh, I remember burying that there.
We've got ways of dating stuff like that. Specifically, they're going to look at the ice strata in which it's contained.
Okay, so we're... I was going to go with, okay, we're about to have the argument of how old is the Earth, but we're not going to go there.
No, we're not, there's no need to go there at this point.
Yeah, because, you know, you and I have probably similar viewpoints on that away from the science side, so.
You might be surprised. You might be surprised by what I really do believe. So.
Okay. That'll be an option.
I really don't worry about what you two clowns believe. I'm worried about what that virus believes, because I believe it ain't going to have any coffee.
All right. Obviously, I have missed something in the science news, because I've been a little under the weather this week.
What haven't you missed? I mean, EW sent me the little text. And went, let's talk about time travel. And I went, wow, let's see. They just found a new lost city. We just discovered another line of hominid we didn't know existed. And somebody wants to wake up a 30,000-year-old. And I love the word giant virus.
Giant virus.
Like we needed an extra adjective.
Yeah.
We do, always.
Apparently, thing is like humongous. So it was big enough to find.
It was an author who discovered it and said, okay, well, we got to make sure the adjectives are put in there.
No, well, that would be a marketing executive.
Oh, okay.
The latest find described online Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences appears to belong to a new family of megaviruses that infect only amoeba.
Bad day to be dysentery.
Boy, this is the truth. The reason for using the adjective giant in there is therefore to invoke the concept of megavirus. And if that's the case, and if it truly does belong to that particular family, then we probably don't have anything to worry about. What we've got to worry about is if it doesn't belong to that family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have no doubt that the next episode of Pacific Rim could star one of these viruses, so...
microbiologist Jean-Michel Clavery of some university in France that I can't pronounce because I didn't take French.
Wait, you said his last name, but you couldn't pronounce the location?
That's what I was about right now.
That's
why we give them the English
initials. Mother Marseille University.
Okay.
Quote, we know that those non-dangerous viruses are alive there, which probably is telling us that the dangerous kind that may infect humans and animals that we think were eradicated from the surface of the earth are actually still present and eventually viable in the ground.
Hmm.
So digging up this one we may find us that we'd rather not find.
It's not the ones that we find that actually bothers me.
It's the ones that find us.
You got it.
Right.
I don't want somebody's little fluffy hanging around in Upper Norway, you know, discovering the, you know, the muskox version of Ebola. Of, you know, this is, you know, we
have enough trouble with Ebola itself.
Oh, yeah, you know, we talk about science and these things happening all the time, but, you know, honestly, we are living in that era. This stuff is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, here's some things that we have come out that claim to be so-called evidence towards time travel. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, being that that's some of the topics, you know, we look at a couple of things, you know, the most common time travel shows was, you know, like Sliders, but they were kind of messing more with, dimensions more than time travel, I would assume.
I like Quantum Leap myself.
Quantum Leap. Yeah. That was one of my favorites as well.
You know, that show never ended, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's still leaping.
You know,
well,
that would explain that whole Star Trek thing.
Oh, yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
He just leapt into Captain Kirk and never left, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, now he's leapt. I'm sorry. Now he's leapt into New Orleans where the food's better.
Oh, yeah. Can't argue with that. I actually did see an episode of that, and it wasn't too bad. He's not great on his Louisiana accent, but.
Yeah. Wasn't he in one of those thingy mabobs, whatever he called it, a hologram?
Yeah, that was Quantum Leap.
Okay. Well, it was truly his
family. Mom.
Yeah, that's her scientific side. but the, last but not least, the most common one that keeps people wondering about time travel is Doctor Who, which has been a long-running show up to this point. And every
funny, he means since 1963. So.
Yeah, I mean, versus other shows. How many TV shows can you say have been running since that time?
None.
Well, you know, I do actually get to remind people that I am actually older than Doctor Who.
I wasn't going there.
Right?
I'll beat you to the punch.
Okay.
Who?
Exactly. Well, one piece of evidence that came up was in December of 2008, Chinese archaeologists discovered a giant tomb that was believed to be an undisturbed 400-year-old coffin of, and I'm probably going to slaughter the name, Si Qing in the Shaanxi country. I hope I said that right, or county.
Gesundheit.
Say that again.
Gesundheit.
Yeah, exactly. Before they managed to crack the lid and find out what was inside, they came across something even more amazing than a centuries-old bag of bones in the soil around the outside of the tomb. A small piece of golden metal shaped like a watch with the time frozen in at 10:06, and the word Swiss was engraved on the back, and the watch that couldn't have been more than 100 years old. So they want to know how in the world did this watch end up getting there. And they've come to the conclusion to say that it had to have been time travel because the Ming Dynasty, of course, wasn't until the 15th and 16th century. And, you know, here's a watch that's not even 100 years old and tiny, mysteriously appearing here in the tomb. Or, you know,
and it never occurred to anybody to think that somebody pulled a fast one on them and just planted it there?
That would have been my first thought.
Actually, I'll do you one better.
Okay.
Of course, no one would ever break into or rob a tomb.
No.
Nobody would ever do something like that.
That would
never happen.
Now, but mind you, this thing is tiny. It's, you know.
And lose their watch in the process, maybe?
Well, when I say tiny, it would fit a number two pencil.
Okay. Okay.
Well, now, what?
The watch.
What? The watch?
Yeah.
I'm thinking somebody's kid's having a good time with something made out.
Yeah,
exactly. That's
made at the Hop Sing factory over there someplace. I mean, I don't, please don't take that in a derogatory term other than, A, there's, every time you come across these types of claims, where something modern is found in an ancient setting,
mm-hmm.
of you got problems, you know, you know, you got problems because here's the problem. Nobody in some of these architectural digs, and I'm using the word architectural for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody does. Well, he doesn't know the difference between architect and archaeology. Yes, he does. Of a lot of times in these very archaeological, architectural digs, you are dealing with a lot of people doing a lot of different things at different points in time. And
he doesn't mean different points in time in terms of spans of centuries or millennia.
Right. I'm talking 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Crews are going in. Crews are coming out. things get dropped. Stuff happens.
Right.
And so, you know, his new fancy schmancy G.I. Joe Swiss timepiece that he was going to give his kids falls out of his pocket, or this work crew went further than they were supposed to go. You know, things get out of, you know, these type of digs. You know, we would like to think they run as smoothly as they do at the beginning of Jurassic Park.
Right.
They don't.
Yeah, yeah, the beginning of the film. Don't worry about the middle or end, just the beginning.
You know, just a simple ghost investigation when you tell people to eat sensibly and wear the right kind of shoes. And everybody shows up in high heels, Rocky Horror costumes, and they all had dinner at Taco Bell.
Yeah.
It's going to be an interesting night.
Well, now, wait, you know, I want to know. I'm sorry, Stephanie. Go ahead.
I've been on a dig before. I mean, farmer up in Tennessee, back when I was going to university, he found bones sticking out of the... And so the first thing he did was to call in the cops and ascertain that it wasn't a human. And then he called the university. And so the geology department got... We had several professors and a whole bunch of us volunteered to go out there and help. And what we found was that it was an articulated skeleton. What was there was articulated, meaning that it was still all in the proper position for a full skeleton, as opposed to a bone here and a bone there, and you know the leg bone's not connected to the ankle bone, and the ankle bone's not connected to the foot bone. But what we also discovered was that the stream had cut into it, and so part of it was missing. So several of us got sent downstream to see if we could spot, just offhand spot, any bones lying around, either on the bank or on the creek bottom. And so, you know, here's truly, here I am, you know, wading down through the creek. It's just cool. It's summertime. It feels good. It's not snaky and it's clear. And of course I get to the deep part and promptly slip and fall in. So, you know, this is the sort of stuff that happens. And yes, I lost the stuff out of my pocket. So it does happen. Archaeologists are people too. So.
All right. Well, let's take another one. It's kind of a little more, I guess it would be the oldest and probably most confusing unexplained story that has time travel related to it. Comes from a small chateau located on the grounds of Palace of Versailles in France. I hope I said that.
Versailles.
Versailles.
Thank you. During the evening of August 10th, 1901, with a couple of academics who found themselves untethered from history and hanging out with Marie Antoinette. No word on whether they chowed down on some cake with her or not, but probably, you know, they spent most of their time freaking out that they were hanging out with a lady who died a century beforehand.
Well, either somebody was playing a right practical joke on them, or they'd been into. It's really funny because I've got a program on. It's that Mysteries in the Museum show, and they actually are talking about absinthe. So I'm thinking somebody had a little too much absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, Pam would know about drinking that absinthe.
Not me. Absinthe. Absinthe makes the heart grow fonder.
No, it makes the heart go wander.
That too.
Yeah, that too. Well, how about...
Okay, so let's restate the case again.
Uh-huh.
So who was actually in there?
Marie Antoinette.
No, not Marie. She's dead. We
right.
got that.
Oh, well, who would be in her?
Was it that was purporting to have seen her.
They have asked. Oh, okay. Here we go. No. Hold on. I'm trying to make sure.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The well-traveled. Okay. Here we go. Charlotte Ann Moberly and Eleanor Jourdain.
Okay. So we have two women. What are they? They're archaeologists.
It's,
they're...
it's actually very vague. I'm looking at this.
Yeah, and there we go.
And it would be very vague. I mean, you know, it's...
Their statement. Jourdain actually wrote a letter stating everything suddenly looked unnatural, therefore unpleasant. Even the trees seemed to become flat and lifeless, like wood worked in tapestry. See, already I'm starting to think like you guys are just by these two lines. There were no effects of light and shade, and no wind stirred the trees.
What kind of joy juice were they on?
That's what I'd like to know.
I think when you drill down into this story, you know, we can't even get through the initial broadcast of the story without holes that you could drive, you know, an 18-wheeler through.
A Mack truck through, yeah.
Yeah, pretty easily. And I always like to tell everybody about being a skeptic. You know, being a skeptic is not the person that just automatically says no.
Being a skeptic is the person who sits there, and I was a scientist, I was trained as a skeptic too. The way I look at it is, I sit there and I poke as many holes into it as I can, and then I look to see what's left.
Mm-hmm.
And what's left is either a sieve, or it's something that actually holds up. And
all right,
if you'll pardon the pun, holds water.
All right. Well, what about this one then,
so,
Stephanie? Because I think you could see this one having some kind of realism in it versus, you know, because, you know, we've heard about strange things in flight and so forth. So this might have something. Sir Robert Victor Goddard, I don't know how to say his last name. Anyway, he was a senior commander in the Royal Air Force during the Second World War, who is best known for his later appearances in pop culture, including the 50s movie The Night My Number Came Up, based on the bizarre incident in his career, which was characterized with bizarre incidents. And his later years spending investigating and lecturing on flying saucers. Before all of the weirdness started up, however, he was a Royal Air Force pilot with a pretty impressive war record, fighting in both the First and Second Wars. Between them, he was selected to read engineering at Jesus College, Cambridge, and then studied at Imperial College, London. So, you know, pretty intelligent gentleman. So obviously,
yeah, he was an air marshal.
Yeah. So in 1935, he became deputy director of intelligence at the Air Ministry. So presumably he was of sound enough mind to for British government.
I know what Alan's thinking. I'm sorry.
Now, which might not be saying much, but we're just, you know, at this point, setting up what a credible source he was before we get into the weird stuff. Now, according to the book Time Travel, A New Perspective by J.H. Brennan, this gentleman suffered his own time slip while flying over the former Royal Air Force Station, Drem Airfield. Charlotte Ann Moberly and the two ladies we mentioned earlier literally stumbled into another period of history, as we've mentioned, but not this guy's case. Having left the disused airfield near Edinburgh and having found it to be a dilapidated state with cattle grazing on the ground, that had forced through, you know, cracks in the tarmac, he ran into some trouble on the flight home and decided to fly back to Drem to get his bearings. Upon his return, the heavy rain abruptly changed the bright sunlight, and the airfield was in full working condition, and mechanics in blue overalls were presiding over four yellow planes on the runway, none of which he recognized despite his vast aviation experience. He didn't land, he just kept on keeping on and never spoke of the incident to anyone. 4 years later, the Royal Air Force started painting their planes yellow, and the mechanics' uniforms were switched to blue.
Okay.
So what did he see?
Was it, can you put this in the form of a question?
Of course.
I will start this. When was the last time you ever saw a man pull over and ask for directions?
Yeah, well, I would really like to see this guy in a plane, you know, just kind of roll down the window and say, hey, buddy, where are we? You know, I don't see that happening.
All right, let's start with the concept of an airport and airstrips and roadways and directions at the time of this incident did not exist.
Right.
Dwight Eisenhower had not begun the Eisenhower Project. So the modern person is sitting here thinking, well, how do you miss an airport? Oh, my God, they're huge. How do you, you know, there's an, obviously a time frame here, obviously.
Yeah.
Especially if you did it today.
This was prior to 1930. This was in 1935, so it was well prior to World War II. And World War II was when they built the really big RAF bases. Like Rendlesham and Woodbridge, which actually were built so big and where they were, which was on the East Coast, so that if they had planes in emergency coming back from runs over Germany, they had a close place to land and a big enough airfield that they stood a chance of hitting it. This was a good 5 years prior to that, and so yeah, you're right. The airfields would not, the emphasis on airfields as opposed to the modern airport. So it's not going to be very big.
And it's also not going to have, you know, like when we think of, you know, aerial directions. When you look at the U.S. from above today. Everything's farmed, everything's got a shape, the roads are nice and straight, and we have all these now.
Wait, you're saying U.S. roads? No, I think you're looking at the wrong U.S. roads.
Well, according to the Eisenhower Project, X amount of space on every given interstate had to be long enough and straight enough to land an airplane on. And the reason for that was because of the hedgerows and the crazy little winding roads all over Europe. Driving Eisenhower crazy during World War II, because a lot of times you could see where you needed to be, but you couldn't get there from here.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you might have to drive 5 miles up to the next village to cross the creek to get back to come back across, because on where you're at, there's heather and marsh and moors, and you're going to lose your tank in the soft soil if you try to take. Now, another common effect, and this happens to drivers, this happens to this very day, people get a little tired, they get a little turned around, and you think you're someplace you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that happened in World War II. It was really funny, and I actually...
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there's still 50 minutes left in that episode. If you want to hear the whole thing in its entirety, you can go to archive.org/details/paranormal, the way we spell it, and check out the entire show. Don't forget to check out the show live on TMV Cafe Radio at tmvcafe.com every Friday at 11 p.m. Eastern. Until then, enjoy. We'll see you next time. Good night.